All right, so open your Bibles to Revelation. We're going to look at chapter 17 and 18, and then the first 10 verses of 19, just because that's where a natural break is in the theme right here. Now, this is a large section of Revelation, about 2.5 chapters, just talking about the harlot of Babylon. So I want you to understand it's a very important topic, and it's not just an important topic for the last days. It's an important topic for right now. This is practical and relevant right now. What I'm hoping you're going to see as I'm going through this is you're going to see all kinds of just contemporary examples from the news, from whatever, that you're going, oh yeah, I see this. That is going on. I want to prepare you. God spent 2 chapters talking about this because he wants to prepare you for what's coming, what actually already is in the earth. Amen? So, we want to begin to look at this. We're going to start with chapter 17. And as always, I'm not going to read 2.5 chapters to you. So follow along with me. And I'm just going to comment on these. It would always be good. There's references in your notes that I'm not going to go to all of those. It would be good for you to spend a little time after reading through, maybe looking up some of those references, and it'll give you a better feel for what's going on. Okay? So, we've been through all the seals and trumpets and bowls, and now we're taking this little non-chronological section where the angel goes, hey, John, let's go, come here. I'll show you this harlot Babylon, and I'll tell you all about her because you need to know about this. And so that's what we see starting in 17, verse 1. And what we actually see in Revelation 17 is he describes in a lot of symbol the harlot Babylon. And then, conveniently, so if you're reading books where they're telling you what all these things mean, you don't need to do that. All you need to do is read the second half of the chapter. The angel tells us what everything means. Isn't that wonderful? You don't have to try and figure out, what does it mean that she sits on many waters? He tells us right there in verse 15. This is exactly what that means. And so we don't have to worry. Again, the Bible interprets the Bible. So we have Revelation 17 and 18 are all about the harlot Babylon, specifically about the judgment and destruction of this harlot Babylon, who has deceived the whole earth, as we're going to see, for about 4,000 years. Okay? So it's going to be exciting when that ends. Now, to begin with, there's who knows how many people, books, all this stuff, who's Babylon, and everybody thinks it's this or that or the other, or which city is it? Maybe it's New York City, maybe it's, all that stuff. Let's not get crazy. But I do believe it is literally the rebuilt city of Babylon, which would be in Iraq, in present-day Iraq, about 50 miles south of Baghdad, right on the Euphrates, are the ruins of Babylon. And I believe it's going to be rebuilt, I think it's a counterfeit Israel. I think it's in the same way Israel came back out of nothing. It'll be coming back out of nothing. And I'm going to tell you why. And this is not critical that you believe me on this one. This isn't, if I'm wrong, it's not going to impact in any way Jesus coming or the end times or all that. But I'll tell you why I believe it's a literal rebuilt city. In Isaiah 13 and in Jeremiah 50 and 51, you can go read these later, there are significant prophecies about the destruction of Babylon. And you're going to see two things. First, you're going to see a lot of last days terms in these prophecies that make me believe that these prophecies have not yet been fulfilled, that they're about the last days. I just listed a bunch of them for you here just quickly. You see the day of the Lord, that he will shake the heavens and earth, that it's the time of the Lord's vengeance, that Babylon will receive plagues, that it's a golden cup that made the earth drunk. We'll read that right here in this chapter. There's about an abundance of treasure, and it dwells on many waters. Again, we'll read that in this chapter. And then the admonition to get out of her midst, my people, which we'll see again in this chapter. And The second thing is, if you study about the history of Babylon, and it's really interesting, and I'm really tempted to give you that, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to. You can bother me later, and I'll tell you what I learned about the history of Babylon. But you'll find there's really no historic fulfillment of either Isaiah 13 or Jeremiah 15:51. For example, it speaks of the destruction being by a gathering of kings and nations. Well, that's never happened. That it would be sudden, that's never happened. And that it would be desolate and never inhabited. And again, that hasn't happened. To give you the very, very, very short history, the last time we see Babylon as a significant city was when Alexander the Great conquered it in about, I think it's like 331. And he specifically commanded that Babylon not be harmed, that the infrastructure not be harmed. From then on, so we have a city, a significant city, and it just sort of fades. The people are moved later when his four generals start dividing up the kingdom after he dies. People are displaced from Babylon. It just fades into obscurity, becomes a little village. And then it's just kind of ruined. So we've never seen Isaiah 13 and Jeremiah 15:51 fulfilled. You can't point to it anywhere in history. So I think it's going to have to happen. So I think we're going to have to rebuild Babylon to do that. All that being said, it's really not that much about the city, okay? So if you're thinking it's about this one little city in Iraq, you're going to miss the major point of Revelation 17 and 18. It's about a worldwide religious and economic system that's influencing the entire earth. And this is what we need to focus on, and this is what we need to worry about and concern ourselves with, okay? Now, in verse 1, we're told that she sits on many waters. And again, we don't have to worry about interpreting this. In verse 15, we're told that the many waters are peoples and tribes and nations of the earth. Or in other words, this worldwide religious and economic system has influence over the entire earth. Got it? So this is what we're worried about. The literal city of Babylon is not that close to us, and probably none of us will visit it, and so it's not an issue. But the worldwide religious and economic system, Babylon, is an issue right now as we speak. Okay, now, we talked about this already, so this is just by way of review. When we looked at Revelation chapter 14, the first mention of harlot Babylon, we talked about how there are so many counterfeits. The devil doesn't really have that much creativity. He just keeps counterfeiting what Jesus has done. So the harlot is a counterfeit bride. Jesus has a bride. Satan has a harlot. And there's a counterfeit message. The bride has the gospel of Jesus Christ. The harlot has a counterfeit message. It's a message of licentiousness and pleasure. Okay? And we saw two things in Revelation 13 that when the beast was revealed in that last 3.5-year period. We saw the requirement for the worship of the image of the beast, and we saw the requirement to take the mark of the beast, which is they can't trade unless they take that. So again, we see these two things. I'm really trying to drive these home because this seems to be where this spirit of Antichrist through Harlot Babylon functions. It's about worship, and it's about economics. We see it again. You must worship the beast, the image of the beast, and you must take the mark, or you cannot participate in economics, right? You have to take the beast of trade. So it's, again, this dual system of attack, and these are vital interests in humans, right? Now, I find this also interesting. This has just been a passage. I'm just throwing it in because it's fun. This has been a passage that has always intrigued me. In Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 11 through 19, we have a description of Satan, and he's described, it's a pre-fall description, because he's really pretty, okay? And he's described as the covering cherub, and his body is literally infused with instruments. He's literally made to lead worship. And so we see this beauty and worship aspect of Satan. But we see one other thing. Twice, it talks about his abundance of trading. And I have no idea how that was manifesting when he was in heaven. I don't know if it was like he had a black market thing going on. I don't know what. But it talks about his abundance of trading and how it led to violence. Maybe that was his influence in the earth after the fall. I don't know. What I find interesting is, again, he's defined in these same two terms, worship and economics. Okay? And so these are the big areas where he's going to try to exercise influence. He's really into being worshiped. He would like to be worshiped like God. And for some reason, he's really into trading, and so he's going to use money. Now, we see this in 1 Timothy chapter 6, where you guys know the verse, the love of money is the root of all evil, right? But let's look at what this verse is actually saying. So let's look at verses 9 and 10. Because we have to be careful that we don't fall into the traps that are being laid, and some of those have to do with his loving to be worshipped. Some of those have to do with riches, with finance. And so this is one of those. It says, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts. So they're saying our desire to be rich can be a path to lead us away from God, to lead us into this Babylon world system for which some have strayed from the faith. So we have to be careful. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith. Now, I don't have a problem with you being rich. Go ahead and be rich. But the problem is, when we love money above the love of God, when we start to pursue money, not God has made me rich and I'm still going to be a lover of God and I'm going to use money for his kingdom and, you know, all that good stuff. Does that make sense? So it's not an admonition that you have to be poor. It's saying be careful, because if you get to where you're pursuing money, you're messing with one of Satan's favorite things, and he'll use it to trap you into temptation and snare and lust and all those kinds of things. So you got to make sure your pursuit of God is ahead of that, because we know, again, the scriptures say it's God who gives the power to gain wealth. God makes people wealthy all the time, but he wants us to keep him first, not money. Does that make sense? So I'm trying to lay a foundation here of these twin areas where temptation is going to exist, or where he's going to try and seduce us, okay? Now, so we go on, in verse 2, it says, talking about the harlot, that the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with her fornication. So here's what I want you to see here, that the people were seduced. The people of the earth are seduced by the temptations of harlot Babylon. But the kings of the earth willingly partner with her. I have no idea, you know, when we go through all the political stuff, guys, we have no idea who's pulling strings behind the curtain, do we? But at the end of the day, I do know that all the strings lean back to harlot Babylon, that the kings of the earth will willingly participate in this system to gain power, okay? And so we need to know that. And at some point, we need to not be surprised when this happens. So then we read in verses 3 and then again interpreted in verse 7 that this harlot is carried or empowered by the beast. She's riding around on the beast. We already talked about this when we were looking at 13 and 14 when we were first introduced to the beast. So she's carried around by the beast. She rides on the beast. She's empowered by the beast, the Antichrist. Okay? And in two ways. We see the beast with the seven heads and the ten horns. And we already learned what those things meant, that the seven heads were seven kingdoms that came before and one that will come after. And the ten heads are that ten-nation federation. We read about that in Daniel chapter 7. You guys hopefully remember that. Pardon me, because I'm not going to go over it again. Okay. But here's what I want you to see. The beast empowers her or carries her. So, in history, the seven heads represent seven Antichrist kingdoms where she sits. We see this here in verse 9 through 11. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and then a revived Rome. You read about that in Daniel chapter 7, about the revived Rome, which the Antichrist will come out of, or a revived 10-nation confederation or something like that. Now, Here's what I want you to see, though. This is not just an end times deception. The harlot Babylon has been riding the beast for 4,000 years. The harlot Babylon was influencing Egypt and Assyria and Babylon. You get what I'm saying? Because it says that she sits on those mountains, that she was there. So again, we're talking about a worldwide religious and economic system, and it is not new. It's been deceiving the earth for 4,000 years, okay? And then we learn that in the last days, and we see this, there's one reference there I'll go to. In 2 Thessalonians 2:7, Paul says, when he's talking about the Antichrist, and he said this 2,000 years ago, that the Antichrist is already at work in the earth. So he was recognizing that this is a future fulfillment and a right now concern that the Antichrist is already at work. So the Antichrist, through this harlot Babylon religious and economic system, has been influencing the earth for 4,000 years. I think we're seeing an increase in that influence, but you know, that's just me. Maybe not. Okay? Okay, so in history, we see her through these seven kingdoms, and in the last days, we see her through this 10-nation Antichrist confederation. Again, that's explained in verses 12 through 14. We're told exactly what those 10 horns mean. We don't have to ponder what they are. We're told what they are in verses 12 through 14, that they're a 10-nation, 10-king confederation. We also see it in Daniel chapter 7. Now, we're also told, and this is interesting, that in verse 14, that they will make war against the Lamb, but that the Lamb will overcome them. That is a reference to the nations gathering for the last battle, which we've already talked about at Armageddon, correct? But here's what's interesting. It says in verse 14 that they will gather, that he'll make war with the Lamb will cover them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Who's that? That's us. Good, you guys are learning. All right? Called, chosen, and faithful. Remember we talked about the parable of the wedding in Matthew chapter 22, where at the end of it, he says, many are called, but few are chosen. So the simplest way to look at it is, everybody's called. The chosen are the ones who say yes, and the faithful are the ones who continue to say yes through to the end. Okay? And so I want you to keep that in mind, that the ones who are there are the ones who are called, chosen, and faithful. We can't just... So most of us here this morning, we know we're called, we know we're chosen, but faithful is for the rest of our lives. And so we have to make sure that we remain faithful. Okay, so where am I at? Okay, now verse 4, this is important. In verse 4, we see a description. She's arrayed in purple and scarlet, which are royal colors, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, so she's got money, and having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations, which are the filthiness of her fornications. It's a gold cup. It looks good, but it's full of filthiness, full of abominations. I'm going to boil this down, make this really simple, and we're going to see this again and again and again. This is what I can't underline this and emphasize this enough. What harlot Babylon is offering is power, wealth, and immorality. The kings of the earth partner with her because this is the lifestyle they want. They want power, and they want an elite lifestyle. So they're going to partner with her. And so it's all about seduction. The harlot Babylon is trying to seduce the earth through offering power, wealth, and immorality. I remember the standard saying for old preachers, when young preachers come in, I tell them, you know, watch out for gold, girls, and glory. It's the same thing, right? The same three temptations we see in John, in 1 John, the lust of the eye, the lust of flesh, and the pride of life. Power, wealth, and pleasure, or immorality. Power, wealth, and pleasure. Power, wealth, and pleasure. You got to get this, because we all are going to have to pass this test. We're all going to be offered these things, all of us. And again, this isn't just in the last days. This is the harlot Babylon world system offering them now to to each of us. Do you guys, have you guys noticed an increase in this at all? Okay, good. All right, so here's what's interesting. In verse 5, she's called the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. That seems a little extreme, doesn't it? I mean, it's not, and you know, this name is written on her forehead. It's not just, you know, yeah, she's a harlot. No, she's the source of harlotry. She's the mother of harlots. She's the, catch this, she's the source of all the false religions in the earth. Now, what's that mean? Well, to understand that, we have to go back a little bit into the history of Babylon again. You guys remember the Tower of Babel, Genesis 11? Okay, now, here's what's going on. We read, and I'm going to make this part quick. We read about the Tower of Babel, that they wanted to reach the heavens. They wanted to make a name for themselves. They were after reaching the heavens, but it was for them. They weren't after reaching God. They were after reaching the heavens for themselves. By the way, the simplest definition of witchcraft is to use some other power to benefit myself. Right? Even if it's demonic power. So, they were after reaching the heavens to make a name for themselves. And we know how that ended. God scattered them. He confused their language and scattered them over the earth. Right? Now, let's understand what's going on here. First of all, in Hebrew, the word Babylon means, or the word Babel, I'm sorry, means confusion. Because from Israel's perspective, this is where the nations were confused. In Babylonian, the word Babylon means gate of heaven. Right? Because in their minds, this is where we were making a portal to access heaven. Now, you need to understand this. They were not, you know, God didn't scatter them because he was worried about them showing up on his doorstep. It was much more than that. They were not trying to literally make a tower that reached to heaven. They were after making some sort of religious, you know, edifice that would allow them to access the heavenlies. You understand? They're trying to make a portal to heaven. It's a counterfeit Jacob's ladder. Now, before I go into that, also notice this. Babylon has traditionally been associated with religion in the same way Mecca or Jerusalem would be. In fact, you can, and you're looking at the history of it, Sennacherib burned, he raised Babylon, burned it with fire back when it was kind of a smaller town at this point. This is actually before Jeremiah's prophecy, in case you're thinking that that was that. Sennacherib was assassinated, and then within like 8 or 10 years, they had rebuilt Babylon because of its religious significance. They're like, this is a religious icon. This would be like destroying Mecca or destroying Jerusalem. We had to rebuild this. So it has always been a center of religion in antiquity, okay? And so a source of all these false religions. Now, I said it's a counterfeit Jacob's ladder. In Genesis 28, Jacob's camping out there, and he has a vision, and he sees heaven open and angels ascending and descending on this ladder. And he goes, wow, this is cool. This is an open heaven, right? Later in John chapter 1, Jesus says, it's one of those times he's being honest. Well, he's always honest, but you know what I mean. He's being forthcoming and actually telling people he's the Christ instead of veiling it. And he says, hereafter, you will see heaven open and angels ascending and descending upon the Son of God, right? So this is, it's talking about access into heaven. Now, we are sons and daughters of God, right? So we can have an open heaven where angels ascend and descend upon the sons and daughters of God right now this morning, can't we? But this is a false Jacob's ladder. They were seeking an open heaven for themselves, not God. And so what you get is interaction with heaven without God. Now, what's left there in heaven to interact with without God? Well, there's devils. And that's, remember, we battle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers in heavenly places. And so what we see is the Tower of Babylon was the beginning of accessing false demonic help and religion. Actually, I'm not sure it was the beginning, but it was certainly the beginning of what appears to be organized false religions. Now, so the reason they were scattered was not because Jesus was afraid they were going to show up on the doorstep. It was to slow, because they were the flood had just happened not that long ago, and they were ready to go right back and double down on pursuing demonic interaction. And God scattered them to slow the progression of evil, to slow the progression of harlot Babylon. Okay? Now, I talked to you before about Daniel 8:23, where he refers to how at the end times we will reach what he calls the fullness of transgression. So what God was doing when he scattered Babylon was going, look, this is the birthplace of this worldwide economic and religious false system, and I got to scatter them or they're going to really rapidly progress towards the fullness of sin. And so he scattered them, and it's taken us 4,000 years roughly to get there or to be approaching it. Now, this is not the first time we reached the fullness of sin. The first time was right before the flood in Genesis 6, when we're told that the earth was full of wickedness and violence. And so God judged the earth because sin had reached its fullness, and it was time to do that. And he scattered them to keep that from happening again. Now, here's something interesting, and I'm really not going to speculate on this, so no emails. It's in the beginning of Genesis 6, when we're talking about how wicked the earth is, that we read that little passage about the sons of God coming down to be with the daughters of men, and then there's giants. And so that's all you have. So, you know, people have written entire books on what that means from two sentences. I have no idea, but it might be demonic interaction. And so it makes me wonder if before the first time God said, that's the fullness of sin, I'm going to judge the earth, there was a lot of demonic interaction, a lot of violence. I do know this, and this is my whole point in going here. I believe that in the last days, and the stuff we're reading about in the book of Revelation, in that 3.5-year period, that we will see, one, as Daniel talked about, we know the fullness of transgression, and unprecedented demonic interaction, especially in light of Satan and his angels being cast out of heaven and thrown to earth and being enraging because their time is short. So I think we're going to see those same things, this unprecedented demonic interaction, because that's where this Babylon harlot world system wants to take us. Are you with me? Is this making sense? So there's a little bit of why she's the mother of harlots. We're going to go faster as we get through, so don't panic. And then in verse 6, we see what I'm going to call the two tools of witchcraft. If you want to excel in witchcraft, you've got to be good at these two things. And we see this in Jezebel with the witchcraft spirit. We see this all through. And they are these things, intimidation and seduction. If we look at verse 6, one, the woman's drunk with the blood of the saints. She's having a good time killing the saints. And there's an incredible seduction on her. And we see this in verse 6, and this is probably the most significant part of this whole passage. This is John the Apostle, John who laid his head on Jesus' breast, John who is on the island of Patmos and is having this whole revelation, and sees Jesus in his glory and falls down as dead. And he sees this woman, and it says, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Think about that. He looks at her and he goes, man, she's awesome. She's awesome. And the angel has to kind of slap him in the next verse and go, dude, why are you marveling? Right? I'm telling you, we have to be very careful that we don't underestimate the seduction of this world system. Even John is impressed. John the Apostle, who's seen a lot, who's in heaven seeing this, and he marvels at the horror of Babylon. So let's not think, oh, yeah, I'm good. I mean, we got to keep, that's why all these warnings in Matthew 24 about deception, because the seduction is incredible. So there's this incredible seduction, and if seduction doesn't work, there's intimidation. Okay, I will try and seduce you. If I can't seduce you, I will try and intimidate you, and eventually I'll just kill you. Okay, and that's what's going on. She's joyfully killing those who would expose her lies. Remember, we're going to be the ones in the earth with the truth. We're going to be the ones who understand. We talked about in Jeremiah how it says, in the last days, we will understand fully. And she can't have that. And so if we won't be reached through seduction, we have to be killed. And so she's drunk with the blood of the saints. We see this in Matthew 24, verse 9, in the last days, that they'll be killing the saints, that they will put us to death. I love in John 16, 2, Jesus tells his disciples, there's a time coming when those, when they're going to kill you and think they do God a service. Does anybody know any world religions that do that? Yeah, that is the spirit of this false religion, this harlot, Babylon, Antichrist, worldwide religious and economic system. Okay, now, the other thing, John marvels, again, this incredible seduction. We read in verses 6 through 8 that the people marvel. He goes, the angel goes, John, why are you marveling? Now, the people of the earth, they're going to marvel, but you need to stop marveling, right? And they're especially going to marvel at a counterfeit resurrection. We see in verses 6 through 8, let me find it. The beast that you saw that was and is not and will ascend. It's similar language to Revelation 1 about Jesus, who was dead and yet is alive forevermore. And so he's going to be impressive. They're going to marvel. This again, this is a representation of the harlot Babylon. The world's going to marvel. And as I said, do not underestimate the seduction of this world system. And I'm going to mess with people's theology, but I just want to make it clear here. The Bible is messing with your theology, not Tony. I'm just reading the Bible. So if you feel free to send the Bible emails. You argue with the book all you want, but here we go. It says here that the earth is going to marvel, but not those whose names are written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. Now, let's contrast that with Revelation chapter 3 in the letters of the churches. We read, whoever overcomes, I will not blot his name out of the book of life. So it doesn't appear that we get saved and our name gets written in the book of life. It appears that our name is written in the book of the life from the foundation of the earth. But if we don't remain faithful, it can be blotted out. That's going to mess with some people's theology. But let's keep reading. You need to understand this. 2 Thessalonians 2:3 is very clear. And again, I'm not saying this to try and make you scared. I'm saying this because I want you to get how serious this seduction is and how serious his warnings are that we not be seduced or intimidated into buying into this worldwide harlot Babylon religious and economic system. And so in 2 Thessalonians 2:3, he says, concerning his coming and our gathering together to him, it will not happen unless two things happen first, and one of those is a falling away. There's going to be a falling away. It's not my idea. It's the Bible's idea. Paul said it, not me. I don't know what his email is. Matthew 24, verses 9 through 13, begin to talk about offense and deception, and ends with, he who endures to the end will be saved. There's an element of enduring through this seduction. Amen? Now, Paul, I don't know why. Timothy was a young man. Maybe that was it. I don't know. But Paul wrote a whole bunch to Timothy about this. And so I'm just going to read these to you because I want you to see the nature of this seduction and how it comes after us so that we can resist this. Okay? So in 1 Timothy 4:1, it says, the Spirit expressly says, so probably seems pretty adamant, that in latter times some will depart from the faith, period. The Spirit expressly says that some people are going to quit being Christians in the latter times. They're going to depart from the faith. Why? Because they're giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrine of demons. Because they believe demonic lies. People in the end are going to buy into this demonic system and turn from the faith. 2 Timothy 3, this verse is famous, you guys have probably read this, has a whole list of how people will be acting at the end of the age or in the last days. But I want to just focus on the ones I underlined. It says, because it talks about what we will love. It says, at the end of the age, there will be people who love themselves, love money, and love pleasure rather than God. Love themselves, love money, love pleasure rather than God. Remember we talked about the three-pronged seduction of power and wealth and pleasure, power and wealth and immorality. They love themselves, they love money, and they love pleasure. And it says, here's the interesting part, they have a form of godliness. So these people, if you ask them, are you a Christian? Oh, yes. I believe in Jesus. Now, you're going to have to get more specific and find out what Jesus they believe in. And you'll probably find that they believe in a new and improved, way more tolerant Jesus who's not nearly as picky. Right? Not necessarily the Jesus of the Bible. But they're going to have a form of religion. Okay? So, 2 Timothy 4, it says, the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires. According to what? Their own desires, because they have itching ears. They will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. Well, Pastor Tony, I really like Church on the Rock, but, you know, you've been teaching out of Revelation, and I found another guy who's teaching that, you know, everything's going to be okay and nothing bad is going to happen to me, and that fits my desires better, and so I'm going to go there. That wouldn't happen, right? You getting this? Guys, this is for us. This is for right now. This is in the earth. This is in America. In the church in America. 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 and 10, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. It's going to be very seductive, very impressive. Harlot Babylon is going to be literally marvelous. There will be stuff to marvel at. And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth. You've got to make up your mind that you're going to love truth more than pleasure, more than your desires, more than money, more than all that stuff. You're going to have to nail it down. I'm going to love, I've got to have truth. Even if it's painful, I'd rather have truth than be comfortable. Amen? All right, again, if you have any problems, email Paul. Just using his words. I like blaming Paul because he's not here. All right, so we keep going. We're at the end of chapter 17 now, and we see, this is interesting, this 10-king nation confederation now in these last three verses turns on the harlot and she's burned with fire. Now, the immediate loud question here is why? Why would the beast and these 10 kings who she's been riding for 4,000 years all of a sudden turn and destroy her? Well, there's a reason, and I'm going to explain it to you. Okay? Now, first of all, this is probably talking about the literal city, but unless I think it is. I think it's literally the city being destroyed. And it probably happens in the 3.5 years in the beginning, or early in the 3.5 years of tribulation, when we switch from peace to tribulation. It's probably in that flip. And what some people believe, and if you look at Mike Bickle's notes, he believes this also, that it also is at the end of that 3.5 year period that we saw it last week in the seventh bowl, Revelation 16, that the harlot Babylon is remembered and judged. And so Some people believe that at the beginning of the 3.5 years, what happens is there's a destruction of the religious system, and this is going to make more sense to you in a minute. And at the end, the economic system is utterly destroyed. Just the infrastructure is taken out and is done in two phases. It doesn't really matter either way. It's wiped out. It's taken care of, okay? But those are interesting things to consider. So here's why. I'm going to answer the question why. Why would Satan turn on the harlot and destroy her? Well, here's why. Stage one, which is the last 4,000 years, but especially the first 3.5 years of that 7-year period, the last week of the 70 weeks that we talked about, especially in that, the goal is to loosen men's commitment to moral and religious absolutes. Because how many people are just going to switch from being a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or whatever to, I'm just going to worship Satan now. It sounds like a good idea. I'm just going to worship this beast guy. Okay? And so it's the old frog in the hot water thing. The goal is, in the first phase of his plan, is to loosen men's commitment to moral and religious absolutes. Just to slowly build up during this 3.5 years of peace a high level of, are you ready for this word? Tolerance. We need to be really concerned about that word, okay? Now, it's not in and of itself bad. I think we ought to be tolerant. I think you guys ought to be tolerant of me. But you can go too far with that word, and it can become a doctrine of devils, okay? So there'll be this counterfeit justice movement. Remember, Jesus is coming to bring justice. Well, in those 3.5 years of peace, there's going to be a counterfeit justice movement. You're going to hear a lot of talk about social justice. You hear it a lot now, right? And at the core of that is tolerance. We need to tolerate everybody. No one's noticing that we're not being tolerated. We'll be being killed. But everyone else needs to be tolerated. And so there's this whole religious tolerance thing going on. Let me just say this. Again, if you aren't tolerant, phase two of the plan is intimidation. How many of you, don't raise your hands, this is a rhetorical question, how many of you right now feel like you're being intimidated into being tolerant of something that God says not to be tolerant of in your heart by the world around you? That is the harlot Babylon system. And the warning is, don't go there. Don't tolerate it. Now, you don't have to be mean or harsh about it, but you need to not tolerate these things in your heart. All right? So, I said that there would be a social justice movement in this time. Now, again, that's not bad. Justice is good. Justice for the poor is good. We're told to remember the poor, right? But there's social justice and there's social justice. Let's see if you can catch this one. True social justice treats the poor with dignity and respect and tries to give them a hand up. Right? If all you do with the poor is take care of their needs, if all you do, I'm going to be a little political here, is make government bigger, can anyone catch how this might be a preparation for something in the future? You see it? We're training an entire people. It's basically what socialism does. It trains an entire people that the government will take care of you. It's a by degrees thing, and at some point, that's going to turn into just take this mark, and we will feed you. And we've spent generations training the earth to rely on the elite to take care of us and to feed us, right? So social justice, good. Social justice that builds dependence on the harlot Babylon, not as good. Just a thought. Okay. I've probably done as much damage as I can do. So my point is this. The reason harlot Babylon is destroyed by that 10-nation confederation by literally the beast or the Antichrist, is it's time to shift to stage two. In stage two, we read about this in Revelation 13. We're told that in that 3.5-year period at the end, that that we're going to be required, well, not us, the world will be required to worship the beast or die. It's very simple. So we've gone from a high level of religious tolerance to zero tolerance. Worship the beast or die. And now, there's no room for the harlot religious system because there's a new system in town, and it's a worship the beast or die system. So that's why the worldwide religious harlot system is taken out, because it was just phase one to loosen our commitment to moral and religious absolutes to get us ready for phase two, worship the beast or die. That make sense? So that's what I think is going on. And we read in verse 18 that the harlot actually controlled the kings of the earth. Says, and the woman who you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Well, it's not time for her to reign over the kings of the earth anymore. It's time now for the Antichrist to directly reign over the kings of the earth. So the Antichrist will be replacing harlot Babylon with himself. In other words, he's gone from the pretend social justice, blah, 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 to it's just me. Worship me. Right? Does that make sense? Okay, good. We'll go a lot faster through 18, but I'm still going to probably go a little long. So hang in there. Are you learning stuff? Yes. Is this making sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good, good. All right, so in 18, basically Babylon falls and heaven's happy. We have in verse 1 and 2, Babylon has fallen. It's the fulfillment. It matches Isaiah 13 and Jeremiah 50 and 51. Babylon's been made desolate. Okay, it's fallen. In verse 3, again, we see these three things, power, wealth, and immorality. For the nations have drunk the wine of the wrath of her fornication, the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So again, we see those three things. The kings of the earth get power, the merchants get wealth, the people of the earth get immorality, and the threefold seduction. And then verse 4, probably the most important verse in chapter 18. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her judgment. Right? Now, again, God's not saying that if you notice that you're in the last 3.5 years, don't take a vacation to Babylon, no matter how good it looks. Okay, it might look good. I mean, they built Dubai up in no time, and it's pretty impressive. Babylon will probably be like that. He's not talking about literally come out of the city. He's talking about right now, today, come out of this system. Come out of this Babylon worldwide religious and economic system, lest you share in her plagues, lest you get deceived and seduced and caught up and end up believing a lie and having to share in her judgment. You get it? So it's very pertinent. In verses 5 through 7, we're basically told that her judgment is just. Heaven sees this as justice. And in verse 8, actually in verse 8, 10, 17, and 19, we're told that it's sudden. And so again, this fits the narrative in Isaiah and Jeremiah. In 1 Thessalonians 5:3, says they'll be saying, peace, peace, and then suddenly destruction. And so it's a sudden and just judgment. And this is interesting. If you go on, he looks at the kings and the merchants. First, he looks at the kings in verses 9 and 10. And they mourn the loss of their luxury. They mourn their lavish lifestyle. It's gone now. And the power that they had, the power, the influence, the red carpet, all that. And they distance themselves from Babylon, says they stand afar off, because they're afraid of her torment. They're kind of getting, this looks like judgment, and I don't think I want to be near her right now. Right? But then in verse 10, it's interesting. They make this statement. They go, oh, you were so mighty, and yet you were judged. You were so mighty. They valued power. They looked at her as the pinnacle of power, this Babylon, whatever that is, the city or the system, and they're going, you were the most powerful one among us. and you fell in an hour. And it's making them nervous, right? The merchants mourn the loss of revenue. They aren't getting rich anymore. And they distance themselves again for fear of torment. And they say, you were wealthy. You were the wealthiest among us. And yet your judgment came in an hour. And so they're going, wow, power isn't going to save us. Wealth isn't going to save us. In an hour, your wealth and your power did nothing for you. Right? So they're learning. Now, one other thing, there's a whole list of things they got rich on. It's kind of like a department store. There's like 8 floors of different things you can buy. And but at the end of that list, in verse 13, you'll notice it says that they trafficked in the bodies and souls of men. And so I believe we're going to see, I don't think there's going to be a decrease in human trafficking. I think it's going to be an increase. Now, I think we should do everything we can to fight it, but the Babylon system is going to do this. Here's the weird thing. Again, this social justice thing, this Babylon system is going to be doing this peace, take care of the poor. And they're going to talk. In one hand, this system is going to be saying, we need to take care of, we need to stop human trafficking, we need to do this. And with the other hand, they're going to be selling the bodies and souls of men. It's going to be playing both sides. All right? And so it's just talk. Now, where am I at? Oh, okay. Then we get to verse 20, and there's rejoicing in heaven. Now, the rejoicing is over God's vengeance on our behalf. Remember, God says vengeance is His. He will repay. He's allowed to do vengeance. We're not. It's just. It says, so heaven's rejoicing that He's gained vengeance on our behalf. In verse 21, it says He's repaid violence with violence. They were violent, and He's thrown them down with great violence. And so it's a just judgment. And I love this. In verse 22 and 23, it talks about how, again, fulfillment of those prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah, how Babylon will be desolate and inhabited no more. So they're left desolate. Even in the millennium, no one's going to be building cities there. There's a point that's left desolate, that there's no more life in this city. There's not going to be music. There's not going to be weddings. Listen to things. No more life in this city. Now, again, I think this is metaphorical. I think He's telling us there's going to be no more life in this system, that I've killed the city, but I've killed the system. The system isn't going to have life in the earth anymore. Isn't that awesome? And so, because He lists what they've done. It says in verse 23, they've deceived the nations with sorcery, which with witchcraft. We talked about that. And they've killed the saints, verse 24. And so we're rejoicing that there will be no more life in these, what I said were the 10 twin tools of witchcraft, intimidation and seduction. He's going to take the life out of intimidation and seduction. Amen? Now, I'm going to do the first 10 verses in Revelation 19 quickly, because they fit more with this chapter than with where we're going. After that, we get the triumphal entry. It's a lot of fun, so we'll pick that up in a couple weeks. But we're continuing with rejoicing. So in verses 1 through 6, there's rejoicing in heaven. Now, here's why. We're rejoicing for His righteous judgment on the harlot who corrupted the whole earth. So this is, again, the mother of corruption. This system has corrupted the whole earth through seduction and intimidation. And now it's been judged, and we're rejoicing. We're also rejoicing in verse 2 because He's gained vengeance for us for the blood of the saints that's been shed in the earth. Now, verse 3 says, and the smoke goes up forever and ever. We're rejoicing that she will never again influence the earth. Is that worth it? Yeah, who wants to sing a couple songs about that? No more harlot Babylon system influencing the earth. And finally, in verse 6, we're rejoicing that the Lord God all-powerful reigns. I love this. The rejoicing is a multitude that sounds like what? Many waters. The harlot had many waters that she sat on and deceived. God's taken care of that. Now, the Lord has many waters, saying, we are glad that You reign. We want your reign. Isn't that awesome? We get it. We don't want that reign. We want your reign. Now, what I love is the focus now shifts from, remember I said that this was a counterfeit bride, that the harlot is a counterfeit bride, a counterfeit message. So the focus now shifts from the counterfeit bride to rejoicing over the real bride. And he begins to talk about his bride. He says, the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride, or his wife, has made herself ready. So he goes, yep, we've dealt with the harlot. Now let's just look at the bride. Isn't that cool? And it says, the bride has made herself ready. In verse 8, it talks about her being clothed with the righteous acts of the saints. All, remember I talked earlier about the ones who were riding with him were called, chosen, and faithful? Listen, Jesus does most of the making us ready. He died to make us righteous. You know what our part is? Stay faithful. That's it. So the bride has made herself ready. We're worthy because we just stayed faithful through tribulation. We stayed with him. We kept, we allowed tribulation to refine us to be more like Christ. We didn't choose the easier route. And so we just stayed faithful. And then it says in verse 9, there's a marriage supper. It says, blessed are those who come to the marriage supper. This is where we begin to experience the true pleasures of the Lord. The harlot Babylon was offering pleasure. But we're going, nope. We stayed faithful. And now, what's the reward? The marriage supper, the true pleasures of God. I love Psalm 16. At his right hand are pleasures forevermore. Psalm 36, there's a river of pleasures flowing out of him. The pleasures of God will surpass any pleasures that harlot Babylon could have offered. But we have to stay faithful and get there. Now, this is going to blow your mind. This is awesome. Remember, we keep talking about how Exodus is a foreshadow of Revelation. We've gone back there again and again and again. The plagues, all those things that we see in Exodus are a foreshadow of Revelation. Moses is a foreshadow of the faithful church in the book of Revelation, praying, calling down the judgments of God, all that stuff. Well, in Hebrews chapter 11, there's this passage about Moses that's really interesting. And we see that he overcame the same three things that we're going to have to overcome. It says, by faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called son of Pharaoh's daughter. That's a position of power, isn't it? He could have been a son of Pharaoh and been powerful in Egypt. It says he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. When offered to compromise with pleasure, he said, no, I'm going to suffer with the people of God. He esteeming the approach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked for the reward. So again, we see this Exodus parallel in Moses, our forerunner. He was offered power. He was offered pleasure. He was offered treasure. He was offered the three things that the mystery Babylon system offers everyone to compromise. And he said, nope, I would rather suffer affliction because I see there's a reward. I see the marriage supper of the Lamb in surpassing pleasures. Amen? Does that make sense? Is that motivating? All right. So Paul called it momentary light affliction. And we'll have to go a long way to surpass his momentary light affliction. Let's get to the wedding supper of the Lamb. Amen? All right. The final thing in verse 10, John's just having a weird day here. He marveled at harlot Babylon, and the angel had to slap and say, stop that. And now, he's just a little confused. It's all a little overwhelming, you can imagine. And he starts to worship this angel because he's so enraptured with this message, I think. And the angel goes again, slaps him and says, get up, stop that. I'm a servant of God just like you. And he makes this interesting statement. It says, the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. What that basically is saying is that all prophecy at the end of the day is just talking about Jesus, all of it. If it isn't pointing at Jesus, it's suspect. In fact, in 1 John chapter 4, which John should have remembered because, you know, he wrote it, said, the way, yeah, I don't know his email either. It says the way that you test the spirits to see whether they're of God is you ask them about Jesus. What do you say about Jesus? Right? It says that's how you tell the spirit of Christ and the spirit of Antichrist. What do they say about Jesus? So at the end of the day, it's always about the full testimony of Jesus. And I underline full there, whole Bible testimony of Jesus, not what you think historically Jesus might have been because of your cultural preferences. The real Jesus. It's always about the full testimony of Jesus. The point of this passage at the end here is John was tempted to be impressed with the harlot of Babylon. He starts to worship the angel because the angel is real impressive and glorious and has an awesome message. And the angel's saying, look, I'm going to make this really, really, really simple. Jesus is the only one worthy of worship. Just make sure you keep worshiping him and nothing else. Amen? All right.